Well, hello everybody. Welcome to Sonic Talk, episode 796. That's what we're at today. Sorry, I was a bit distracted because the live stream is minutes behind. I have no idea what's going on there. It must be some heavy congestion on the interweb. So I hope it's all getting to you folks fine. Love to see our friends in the chat room going there. Wagyu doing his best as ever to do the moderation and keep the whole sort of cross-posting chat mechanism that we have exclusively at Sonic State here working for us. I think he's even doing it from a train. That's how dedicated he is. So thanks very much to Wagyu. Nice to see Scott from Canada, Robarth, Azzy ahead. Well, there's a load of people, I think. Failed Muse. Oh, he's a guest as well. How curious. a bunch of people there. So very nice to see you all. This is the Music Technology Podcast. We'll be talking about all the things to do with music tech in the news, whether it's streaming, synthesizers, instruments, software, just interesting videos, a social comment, all that kind of stuff. It'll be coming along. I'd just like to say, Synth Samurai is in the house there somewhere, or was. Yeah, there he goes. Nice to see you, Synth Samurai. I've seen your show a few times. I'm sure we've quoted it once or twice. I should also say, quickly, coming up, we have a few things. Don't forget, I haven't mentioned this before, but our competition, which is win stuff with Sonic Couture. I've got the link right this time. It's not going to a spam site. If you join, not only do you get a chance to win, but you also get a sneaky exclusive 30% off token from them. So just by entering, you get a 30% discount. That gets emailed to you once you've verified your entry. So do check that out if you want to win ACDR, which is the acoustic drum machine. And there's a whole bunch of other prizes worth up to £1,000, which is an astonishing prize. We thank them very much for that too. Anyway, let's get on to our guests. We have, oh, that's not Paulie, that would be Richard Nicol, but this is Paulie Alex Bow here. How are you doing, Paulie? You good?
Yeah, not bad, thank you. I had the week off from parenting, so this is why
what a release.
This is why I'm looking refreshed and, you know, and well rested. But yeah, it's been going okay. I also found out that I don't need to do all of the mixes on my the sound mixing on the Arcade Dreams project, so I'm kind of off the hook, which is cool, because it wasn't as fun as composing the soundtrack, you know, so I'm very happy that I got to do all the fun stuff and leave the nitty-gritty of mixing, you know, dialogue and stuff to someone else. It gives me time to be creative, you know.
And how do you feel about that? I mean, because that's sometimes, if that's an integrated, because it's a hard thing to give up sometimes, but if you've put all the effort into the actual music creation, then perhaps it must be quite a relief. Yeah.
I mean, I did it, and there were some creative bits which were fun, you know, like putting little bits of reverb and stuff on different clips and archive clips and stuff like that, you know, to blend it together. But I believe I'll still be like credited for whatever work I did, but
yeah.
It's not as fun as making music.
Yeah,
so I'm glad I'll have more time to make music, essentially, and you know, so that's really good. I got some new stuff. I've got my usual what crap has Paulie gotten this week.
Okay, let's have a look.
Bit for you. One is something we might be chatting about later. It literally just came in the post. It is a cool drum log.
A drum log. Okay. Nice.
So that's cool. I'm looking forward to, you know, diving into some of the weird and wonderful user SDK engines. And the other one is this. Oh, it's heavy.
I never know what we're going to see next. Okay.
it's so heavy. Thing. It's a Casio VZ8M.
I've never seen one of those before. That's one U.
Casio VZ8M.
Oh, nice.
So it's like a phase distortion synth, basically. Sounds slightly similar to like Yamaha FM, but it's got a ring modulator as well.
Heresy.
There we go. Heresy. And it's based on saw waves, most of it, and not sine waves. So there's your main differences. It kind of has some similar tonalities. But it's got ring modulation and saw waves. So, yeah, I'm going to be digging into that. And that's Nick, me.
Nick House says it doesn't sound at all like the CZ either. So it's a very different sound.
It doesn't, no. Yeah. Okay. Pretty cool.
Well, thank you, Paulie, for sharing. We've also got another guest who very kindly jumped in at the last minute when I realised that Richard Nicol probably didn't realise that he was actually not an hour away from show start. Rob Pericelli, failed muso there, looking very well equipped. I see the DX1 has been replaced by, is that a Poly or a Matrix Brute? I can't tell. Oh, it's a Poly Brute, isn't it?
Poly Brute,
nice.
Yeah. One of my favourites, that one. Yeah,
it really is a brilliant synthesizer. I know, yeah. I don't think they had the same stuff that happened with other analog polyphonic synthesizers at release, which was really hard to stay in tune, and they had to work like crazy. I mean, I'm sure there were some scrabbling behind the scenes, but
you know.
All fixed. No, anyway, Rob, how are you? You good?
Brilliant. Yeah. Busy. It's just never ending. I thought Easter might come and I'd get a chance to put my feet up, but no, because there's lots of things to write about and lots of things to put together and preparing for things later in the year. We've got Superbooth coming, so I'm trying to get things kind of organised for that and other shows as well and writing stuff. And I just found out today that a thing that's supposed to be here for me to review ahead of its launch shortly isn't going to be here and might not get here, or it might get here with like 24 hours to spare, so it's going to be a really hectic kind of thing.
I shy away from those 0 days. It's just like and I'll tell you what it is, and I had a thing that happened recently, and I know it's kind of fun to hit the deadline and all that stuff, but sometimes I think, well, if us as independent reviewers are being asked to kind of basically fit in with your marketing plan, then surely that's a paid gig rather than an editorial gig.
I mean, this is for this review will be a written review, you know, for us oldie types that don't do videos or do less of them. So it's going to be a written review, so it's going to have to go and obviously get edited and all this kind of stuff. But I am hoping to do something live with it. And I can't say any more than that because obviously it's all a bit NDA-y. But it's very exciting, and it's this year I think is going to shape up to be quite an exciting year for all sorts of different reasons. So yeah, looking forward to it.
You might be right. I think Superbooth is going to be quite interesting for sure.
It is.
I think there's definitely going to be some big boys and girls showing up for that one, which should be nice. And I think that's one thing that's quite interesting. I've noticed that much earlier in the process, because Superbooth is in May the 16th, I think it is. Is it 16th or 17th? Yeah, 16th.
16th to 18th, yeah.
And I've been hearing that people who normally go are saying, oh gosh, we might have left it a bit late for a booth, you know, which is quite unusual because normally they're quite accommodating. But so I think it's going to be a big one. So we only hope that Superbooth itself will be, the weather will be good, because they have to put more people outside, which when it rains is a very different experience.
If it's like last year, it will be amazing. Because the weather last year was just bang on. It was about as good as it could be. Yeah, it wasn't too hot, but it was warm enough, you know, for it to feel really summery. But I'm going a day earlier this year and leaving a day later, so I'm doing a whole 5-day thing in Berlin, which I cannot wait to do.
Great city, great fun. Yeah. Well, despite all of this peddling and flim-flamming that I'm encouraging my guests to do, we still don't have no Richard Nicol, but I get that, and that's fine. I am sorry, Richard, that's totally my fault, and if anyone was looking forward to seeing him, you may not. I suspect maybe within 10 minutes. We'll see. We'll see how that works. I've got his fader down in case he kind of curses wildly as he tries to connect. just in case. You just never know what might happen. Let's get on to... perhaps we should do a topic. Let's see what's first. Well, of course, anyone get April fooled? I do have a video which seems to be the one that kind of mostly got... Because there's much less of it these days. So let's just enjoy a bit of this. Or not enjoy. It's very weird. You can't unsee it, can you?
No.
This is OnlyFans. Robert Fripp doing OnlyFans. He's obviously a game old bird. And yeah, so that was it. Robert Fritt, OnlyFans. I think that might have been Miss Toya's doing. I bet she encouraged you. She's probably a very bad influence on him, if you've ever seen any of the Sunday. But there were we did our very own, which was the Zella Labs Paradox, which was the work of Paulie and Midiera. The machine learning algorithm that takes a snapshot. I think I've got a... I've probably got a screen here somewhere. Did I have a screen? Yeah, I think there's one, yeah. That takes... Oh, gosh, bloody cookies and everything. You've got to do all of this stuff every time I run it. Yeah, this was the take. It's got fungal bellows. The idea is
fungal bellows.
Fungal bellows. It figures out what notes it thinks you want to play somehow via AI and plays them for you. And I thought it's actually quite hard to do an April Fool's, and there are less and less of them. And I think it's partly because it's so easy to offend somebody or other. That kind of narrows down the channel of jokes that you could do at less expense and without great elaboration. So I don't know if anybody else saw one. Paulie, did you? Well, you obviously contributed to that one. There's a quote from you in there. What did you see any that were good in the music tech space?
One of my friends read our article and she said, oh, that's really interesting, yeah. I mean, some of the things have weird names, like fungal bellows, but this sounds like amazing technology. And I was like, well, I'm glad that I have your unswerving trust, you know, as a friend, because that was an April Fool's joke. So there we go. That made me laugh.
Well, so job done.
I saw Robert Fripp. I didn't see many more, but on one of my retro computer groups, I told everyone that I'd taken all of my Amigas to Oxfam and I was now going to be a vintage Macintosh musician working in black and white on Cubase 1.0. And people were saying, and a CRT, and people were saying, you know, What area are you in? You know, where is this Oxfam and stuff like that? You know, or can I arrange shipping and stuff like that? So there we go. But two people actually fell for it. And one guy said, why are you on here asking for our money? Go away. Put this on a Mac forum, beggar. He actually said beggar.
Wow.
Which I was,
so you scored
and then he
twice.
Blocked me. He blocked me, so I was like, so you were right. Even with a quite innocuous joke, Nick, you can really offend people. There we go. Yeah, but we all know that the internet is a divisive place, yes. Like a school playground, and everyone's just chucked together and expected to get along. But there you go.
Yeah, fair enough. I know, Robbie, you're involved in writing and some of the Gear News articles. Were you tasked with an April Fool's project this year, or did you manage to swerve it?
I managed to swerve actually having to deal on what I did one a few years ago with the ProSynth Network when I announced on April 1st that we'd been acquired by Behringer. And I did this graphic. It was the most basic graphic in the world. It was basically the ProSynth Network graphic with the Behringer triangle, you know, with the ear on, just slapped on. And I just said, I'm delighted to announce that, you know, we've been acquired by Behringer, moving forward, blah, blah, blah. And again, most people got it, but some people got very upset to the point where my phone started ringing and they said, are you flipping serious? And I'm like, no, check the date. And it was like, oh. So I'm kind of loath to do it again because I didn't want to upset anyone. Like you said, you know, you're not sure who you're going to upset or offend, but I suppose, you know, if you're going to find people that call you beggars on Facebook and they block you, you've probably done yourself some good there and get rid of them. But I sat on my sofa the night before April 1st and I got a little email ping through, and it was from this synth restoring company in Paris. And it was a genuine email from this genuine business, and we must have spoken in the past, but they you know, emailed me personally. Said, "Hi, Robbie. Just want to let you know we've just put this thing on sale. It's a Sequential Circuits Prophet 20. It's a one of a kind prototype. We uncovered it in a dusty Parisian attic somewhere. Blah blah blah." And it was very well written, and links to the Reverb page, links to their Instagram page, and I click on it. And I see this thing, and the price was €202,020, which then just got me a little bit suspicious because it seemed like, you know, 2020, that seems a bit odd, but I couldn't correlate it with any, like, you know, April 1st thing. So anyway, I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, well, if that is an actual thing, that's worth talking about. So I jump out of my sofa, come to the office, start typing this little news piece up, you know, Rare Prophet 20, and then it just kind of, the penny eventually dropped before I hit publish or anything. And I thought, have they gone early? Because obviously now in this 24-hour world that we live in, yeah, it's April 1st somewhere.
You hit the people writing the story. Yeah, nice.
Exactly. Yeah, so luckily, I know a couple of people that worked at Sequential at that time. Chris Meyer was one. John Bowen was another. And I quickly emailed both of them. And Chris got back to me straight away. And he said, I was involved with the firmware on all of the profits and I never saw that. So that was a pretty conclusive confirmation. But it turns out that the only part of that that was the April Fool's was the little bit of story about it being a prototype. This thing actually does exist. It's a Prophet 10. It's two Prophet 10s, but one's had the keyboard chopped off and they're connected via MIDI. So you can get 20 voices, 20 Prophet voices, whoa, playing at once. It is a real, real thing. And they're selling it for about 32,000 quid, which is a much more realistic price. But it actually is a thing. And they've built a special stand so you can stand this. Basically, it's a Prophet 10 expander module sat behind it. So it's this massive thing that will always go out of tune and overheat. But hey, you know, it's a lovely
that's
thing.
Interesting. I think about that. Well, I'm just wondering, because a Prophet 10 in good condition has got to be worth, what, more than half of 30 grand,
yes,
I would have thought.
Yes.
So you've actually, what they've actually done is devalued two Prophet 10s to make this Prophet 20, which seems perhaps not what they were going for. I don't know. Yeah interesting.
I almost fell for it, and then thankfully, held my horses. And but as you say, doing April Fools these days is really difficult. A, because we've become very cynical. B, because the internet makes it so easy to fake things. And thirdly, we live in such a world where we can't do satire or comedy anymore about certain things because the world is just crazy enough as it is in reality. So to actually sort of come out and say something cranky for April Fool's Day, most people go, yeah, whatever, and move on and just glance past it. So it's very difficult to actually get an April Fool's right these days, you know.
It's the post-truth world thing, isn't it?
Yes,
things are so ridiculous and so out of order. Well, it's interestingly enough, there is a theory that this all began in propaganda form from within Russia many, many years ago, where they hired... what's the name of the kind of artist? Surreal artists who would just do things kind of completely... ridiculous things, and by flooding people with these kind of ridiculous concepts and ridiculous notions, it kind of changes their opinion on what truth might be and what and how it's perceived. So it's actually it's a kind of studied fact. It's a studied thing that's been taken. So effectively, you know, we're probably being subjected to April Fool's kind of type information every single minute of every single day now.
We've become
desensitized.
Yeah, I just wish that we were this cynical for the other 364 days in the year.
That's
when
true.
We see stuff, you know. But no, you know, it's that one day a year where we discount everything, and then you know, the next day was like, oh, that happened. You know, it's weird world we live in.
Here's a good one. Kissing the Machine says, I've tuned every oscillator on my Solar 50. Only joking. Yes, I've been there. And I thought I'd tune them too. Then I went and made a cup of tea and came back to do a take of the piece of music that I was trying to demo for the review. And they were out of tune. So it didn't actually stay in tune very long. So you may well have, but I doubt if it stayed there for long. I would say the 50, the 42. I forget which one not the most recent one, which I do believe has a much better tuning situation than the one I reviewed, which is still lovely, but nonetheless is very difficult to actually tune, shall we say. Right, let's see, what else do we go next? Oh, let's get immediately controversial, I think. Let's, you know, we've done the April Fools, we've gone flippant. Now let's get some good old-fashioned argumentative, difficult to justify stuff. Right, let's go. This is the video by SoundLab Sound Design on YouTube. And this was 7 low-pass filters. Had to go, really nicely made video, I have to say. I thought he did a great job of this, and Electrics Filter Factory, Behringer Model D, MPC 2000XL, MAM Warp 9, Electrics Filter Queen, MPC 1000, and Ensoniq Mirage with the filters. So, literally, not at all. Well, exactly, basically not at all scientific. But what was really interesting, even with all that gain structuring and all of the things that you would kind of wheel wax on about how important that's, how you, the circuitry before the filter is, I mean, some of these were just digital and have, you know, that didn't really factor in at all. The MPC 2000XL, I'm not sure if that's digital or whether that had analog filters, I forget now. Ensoniq Mirage had a Curtis filter. But basically, I found almost no difference really discernibly from many of these. I mean, there were differences, but ultimately a filter sweep on that source material, I mean, they weren't gain matched or anything, but the sonic characteristics were really similar with no resonance. Just, you know, and then it was just a matter of how the resonance interacted with the filter. And again, there was a lot of difference, but it wasn't chalk and cheese. It wasn't like a SEM filter and a ladder filter. And that made me wonder, are we really kind of getting a little bit kind of over... Most people just kind of, you know, they do a wah-wah mouth or they got a wah-wah pedal. That's about as filtery as one might get. I mean, this is for people who think about it. And I just thought it was a really interesting thing to hear them all up against each other. And I just thought, wow, there really isn't that much difference. And these are considerably different things. Oh, we have Richard Nicol here. He's just jumped in. How are you doing, Rich? It's the hours difference. Yes, I'm going to hide you. But I know it's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, you know, ProSynth Network, you know, you and I are discussing this kind of thing on a daily, if not weekly, basis. And people get really sort of... But this just made me kind of step back and go, maybe you just chose a load of filters that happen to sound very similar. I mean, that's another possibility.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, a filter is a filter, I guess, most of the time. The differences can be heard maybe at the extremes, but somewhere in the middle, they can all pretty much, you know, I say about synthesizers a lot, you know, a lot of synthesizers can sound the same as other synthesizers, even though they're not supposed to. You can get them pretty close. Mm. And it's all about how the user uses them individually. But there are, you know, there's a handful of filters, I would say, and I'm not going to say this just because he showed up, but the filter on the Tiger that I've heard, I've never actually played one. So I'm going to write that wrong at Superbooth, Richard. I'm going to come and annoy you. But I have heard that filter on, you know, various places, and it does have a quality that is not massively different from everything else, but there is a quality there. And I guess if you take that quality and you can, you know, feature that somehow, you know, just boost it a little bit here and there, you can make something sound really, really nice. I mean, I've got stuff with digital filters, lots, you know, the Emacs 2 digital filter is actually a really, really good filter. But I wouldn't say that it's way better than, or way worse than anything else particularly. And I've been messing around with my Yamaha CS6X recently. I just kind of pulled that off the rack, thought, I haven't played this for a while. And the filter on that is actually not bad for a, you know, completely digital synth that's working on mostly samples, although I've got the VL board in there, so it kind of, that gives it a different character. But I quickly watched this and thought, yeah, this is nice, but what's it actually proving? Not a lot. But yeah, nicely made video, but yeah, just interesting discussion thing, really, nothing more than
exactly. But I mean, and I think the thing is also, like I say, there are I agree with the Pittsburgh modular filters. I'm not just saying that because Richard's here, which he's still wrestling with his sound, but let's say I would also say the Dreadbox Erebus Mark II filter is a thing of beauty. It's very unique. And I would also put the Behringer Neutron filter in there as well as a unique and quite sort of different to certain filters. And I think probably the commonality between those is the fact that they're two poles I think, ostensibly anyway. But they've got some other special sauce going on that just makes them sound completely different. Richard, if you give me a thumbs up, I can come to you and introduce you and then put you on the spot. There we go. Richard Nicol from Pittsburgh Modular. Oh, look, he's got a thumb. Wow, look at that. I think your camera's just thumbed up you. Yeah, it's because you're using the latest OS X and it's probably overlaying things via your camera. Richard, lovely. Thanks. I realised as I was going live that the clocks haven't changed in America. They have changed, however, in the UK, and I didn't bring it to your attention, so I can only apologise.
No, we've I'm just sorry. Watched the se- I should have
We've just checked. Watched the Seven Filters video, mm-hmm. which is what we're talking about.
I watched that one this morning.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? How similar they seemed, really, in broad terms.
Yeah, I think some of them, like the Mirage, had a sort of a crunchy vibe to it. And that I don't think was really necessarily part of the filter. But all those filters, those videos are tough because it looked like they were putting the knobs in the same spot and trying to say this should be a similar sound. But the reality of it is, even from instrument to instrument, even talking about, our instruments or any instrument, potentiometers are 20% potentiometers. So that means they could vary in 20% in either direction. So trying to line up knobs and compare them that way is really, really difficult. And it's really, I think, a filter sort of can give a vibe. And I think what a filter adds that makes a good filter better from maybe a dull filter is you start to get this kind of 3D pop out of it, where it feels like it starts to add another dimension to sound. And I think that's where analog filters really shine, is this ability to add additional depth to a sound. I think, the Moog ladder filter obviously does that very well. I think the old Roland filters that were in like the Juno 106 and the Juno 60s, those type of filters had that sort of 3D sound to them. And, that's what we try to work on as well. But so, the double rack mount unit in that video, I thought had a really nice sounding filter. It had a lot of character to it. But the rest of them, I thought sounded
maybe one of the electrics.
Yeah.
Or filter queen. Yeah.
And I remember years ago, a friend of mine had one of those, and we just pummeled it with drums and guitars, and we always felt like it had a good sound to it. But it filters, in addition to having sort of a personal, everyone has their personal favorite, I really think there is a way to sort of judge them, but people hear things differently, so it's hard to say. Mm. And that video, I thought... did a nice job of letting me hear some filters that maybe I hadn't really paid attention to in the past, like the Mirage or the MPC 2000, which I hadn't really ever listened to the filters on. But I'm not sure. But I didn't hear any filters except for the electrics that maybe had any 3D to them in that video at all.
Interesting. That's interesting. I'd like to put a case forward for the digital filter in the Roland S-Series samplers, the TVF in that. That was whippy as hell. But that's another thing. I know, Paulie, this is interesting because, you've got analog stuff and digital stuff. I mean, it feels like maybe SoundLab Sound Design chose what they had lying around rather than maybe what would make a good spread of different sounding filters. That's what I'm sensing here.
It could be that potentially. I know from like my own experience that I can get filters sounding very, very different, usually from the extra little bits of topology and features that are put in them. So let's see. For instance, around here, I really like hybrid synths, with digital waves into analog filters, because the kind of crust of the digital wave just gets nicely accentuated by the analog filter. So like, for instance, the Shruti Mutable Instruments has a Polyvox filter in it. And because of the gain staging, you can really make it scream in like wild distortion. and also FM the filter with one of the digital oscillators. So then you're kind of into very unique territory, I think. So I like the romance that some instruments have, you know, that some hybrid instruments have, like the Akai VX90 with its CEM chips. The romance of things like the Korg DSS-1, which has Korg's own 24 dB filters in, and the resonance just sounds absolutely incredibly expensive on it, which I absolutely love. And it's a very wide sounding instrument, and it's a very wide looking instrument. It's an aircraft carrier. I even put a little toy plane on it because it's an aircraft carrier.
Why ever not? A couple of helicopters.
As you do.
That's it, exactly. And then the other one I really like at the moment, because I can mention this, I guess, is that the Waldorf M just got an update. So it has a digital filter before the analog one, so you can work, you know, with them in series and do cool stuff. And I think I really like parallel sometimes on the Polyboot, but in series filters, I'm a real fan of. So you can actually have a digital FM filter, either low pass or high pass, with audio rate modulation, and then tame it down a bit with the real SSM filter. So I like these combination of quirky filters essentially, but I think it's either more about the vintage romance of the instrument and, you know, how it looks and stuff like that and what the features are, because, you know, I really like stuff like Filter FM, or it's about what weird routing you can do for me. Right. I don't know if that was a coherent answer, but there's my thoughts on filters.
That's fair enough. Yeah, I think I do remember the Electrix series filter, because they were designed to go in DJ consoles, I seem to remember originally. And there was a filter with an envelope. There was a filter, and they also, I think they did like a kill EQ as well, if I remember correctly. And I'm not sure, was there some affiliation with whatever Akai became somewhere, like I can't remember. It's a very dim and distant past that. But there was a thing definitely going on. Certainly in the 90s, there were people who sort of swore by them. Round about the time when the first original Sherman filter bank came out, and just before these sort of standard, they were one of the first actual standalone filters that wasn't kind of like a scientific piece of equipment. And I think that's kind
were
of,
they called stuff so, like Filter Factory and stuff
Filter
like that.
Factory and Filter Queen were the two ones I
Queen,
recall.
Yeah.
And I remember that because they used to
them,
knock them out at 100 quid. Or they knocked them
really?
Out at a sort of reduced price. They were always Was it you, Robbie, who used to work for Turnkey? Do you remember those?
No, that was Robin.
No, it was the Robin,
Robin,
that's right. I knew,
yeah.
I knew I had part of that statement, right? But,
I was just going to say very quickly two things. And Richard, I'd love you to answer this one for me. So the first thing I always go for or look for in a filter is its self-oscillation, because I just turn everything down. I just want to hear what that filter does of its own when you really get it to vibrate, and that can really add something to certain sounds. So I always look for that. And most recently, the IK Multimedia Uno Synth X Pro, had to get all of that in there. That really does. That's screams like a nasty thing, and it can really add to, you know, quality to the sound. So I don't know how that important that is in filter design, whether that's a consideration. But also filters, it doesn't matter how good they are, it's also depending on what you put through them, because if you can only put what the, you know, that particular synth engine through it, well, that's fine, because then the filter's probably tuned or, you know, or it's been chosen for that purpose. But when you start having the ability to put other things through other filters that weren't necessary, that's when they can start to get really interesting. You can actually hear maybe more of what's going on with that filter than with the original, you know, source instrument. So, you know, but yeah, I'm not really au fait with filter design. So maybe, Richard, you can educate me. That'd be fantastic.
Well, fortunately, we do have an analog designer in the, engineer in the building.
Finally, this is the fifth or sixth time I've been on, and something I know a little bit about. you know, all these things are decisions made by the designer. So, you know, if it self-resonates, that's a decision that the designer made. Most filters are going to self-resonate if you want them to. Some of them do it a little easier than others. But like, for instance, I could talk about our state variable filter, the Pittsburgh filter. It has the nice thing about state variable filters is the idea that they have theoretically infinite resonance without self-oscillation. So the idea is that you can have more of that resonance sound without falling and slipping into self-oscillation. That's a feature of the state variable topology and something that we take a lot of advantage of. Now, you can force it into self-oscillation if you want. And typically, every filter I've played around with and ever heard, if you force them into self-oscillation, that you're just going to get a sine wave. And it's almost a perfect sine wave. It sounds very nice. But that's a decision that the designer is going to make. Depending on the filter, another good example would be like the Korg MS-20. The Korg MS-20 uses what's called a Salen key filter. And that is a very unique, and you know the resonance on a MS-20 is sort of nothing, 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 and then it's out of control madness.
It's almost like a feedback.
And that's because the Salen key topology doesn't have a natural bandpass. So bandpass is typically where you pull from when you get the resonance. Resonance is simply passing the bandpass back into the input to create that feedback loop. Right. But the MS-20, there's no natural bandpass there. So you find different ways to do it, and you end up with these, I always call it the resonant knee, where it's just incredibly sharp, almost a right-hand turn on those. But it gives it that character that starts to define the sound. So all depending on what filter topology you're working in, you're going to get different types of responses, and you take that into account when you're designing it. Like, say, if you're using a ladder filter, like a Moog-style ladder filter. Now, the way that works is as you add resonance, you lose low end. While other filter topologies, like the state variable and like the Salen key, you don't lose the low end. But there's a trade-off, because as you add resonance, as you add signal going through, you bandwidth the resonance to the signal. So if you have a strong signal going through a state variable filter, like a Pittsburgh filter, for example, you're not going to get there's not a lot of headroom left for resonance. So if you turn down the signal going in, there's a lot more room for resonance. So gain staging becomes very important. So this is a good example of where the artist then has the control over the range of the instrument and what they want it to sound like. But that just comes down to, you know, an artist really knowing the instrument and understanding how to work with it to get the sound that they're looking for out of it. Because all of these filters, and this is something that you can't show in a video where you're setting the knobs and then quickly sweeping the filter, is all the sort of flavors that are involved with all the other variables. That's sort of my... standing on a box speech about filters today.
I love listening to people talking, they know what they're talking about. I love that.
So you mean
thank you, Richard,
you really don't have to turn it all up to 10? I'm disappointed that there are shades of less. Excellent. Well,
that was one of my biggest frustrations. That was my biggest frustration with Eurorack when I got into Eurorack, was the manufacturers that I thought were making really, really good sounding gear weren't putting attenuators on anything. So there would be CV inputs and audio inputs on all these modules, but there was no attenuators. So people would just plug in an envelope or an LFO, and it would just be full on modulation. Right. So it would everything at 11 all the time. And synthesis is about subtlety and about small variations, chaining them together to create something new at the end. And that's something that I will preach until I'm gone.
Right. Excellent. Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. I think we might have just had the show title, which Let's Talk About Filters. I think that's pretty much a good description of what we've been doing today. Right. Oh, right. Okay. Let's get on to, one of the videos that you contributed the topics for, Paulie. Let's go there straight away. I think we should do that. I know it's a bit guitar-y, but that's fine. We've just had a guitar-based ad. That's okay. Let's do it. which I've now sampled, and that means I can use on the button again. So this is about...
good afternoon.
I'll zip through, because you're playing, basically, you're processing your guitar through
nice
the Amiga
delays.
With a sample,
right,
and there's various different
down the
effects
right
in here.
Oh, dear.
I encourage everybody to go and watch the video. There's some really good sounds in there, but I thought what was really, because I didn't know that it was possible, because I thought the latency would be too high going through an 8-bit sampler. So effectively, the Amiga computer has some form of sample input. I mean, there have, and that's one of the first questions I had for you. Which one was that? Because there are different cartridges that you plug in, and what sort of latency does it introduce? Because there didn't seem to be any there, which was quite interesting.
No. The really interesting thing, and this is all Amigas, whichever one you get, they put like video timing signals in the circuit. So this is why it was used a lot for early kind of VFX stuff. And also the sound chip has direct access to the memory. So, you know, like on an early kind of sampler with a DAC, you have to have a CPU that's writing each individual value to the DAC. That doesn't happen on an Amiga. Basically, you just get like a stream of data, and the chip hands it over to this other chip, Paula, that plays it and just does their own thing for like, you know, until another sample comes through, so, and it can loop it and stuff like that. So it's very, very non-CPU intensive, and that's where the lack of latency comes in. It's not at all CPU intensive to run effects and real-time samplers and stuff through the Amiga. So then your only limitation is the 68,000 processor, whether it can take the sample in from the parallel port, and these are essentially just A to D converters on the little cartridges that I showed. Takes the analog signal, goes through the parallel port, and then goes to the CPU. The CPU adds its delay or whatever, hands it over to Paula, and Paula just plays it like within milliseconds. Absolutely zero kind of latency that I can tell.
Interesting.
It was just, you know, like literally when there was no effect on, it was literally like I was just playing the guitar through an amplifier, essentially. So there we go. I know that was a bit techy, but
no, but that's, I asked the question. But some of those sounds as well, I mean, they really reminded me of what a lot of really expensive boutique pedals are trying to achieve. So you know, some of that kind of bit reduced stuff sounded like those old I forget, we talked about this, but those old pedals that used to have psychedelic pictures on them, the Zvex, you know, where the brown out,
yeah,
they just it sounded, and I was thinking, god, they used to cost hundreds and hundreds of quid,
yeah,
and yet you can build these,
well, the Otto Biscuit and stuff like that.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, it's very interesting.
It's, I think, assembly language is assembly language. So nerds writing algorithms then for a computer that was accessible is the same as nerds writing algorithms now, basically. It's just a different architecture. And it's only kind of limited by the imagination of the person, I think, who's programming it. And it was another chance for me to show off my childhood computer that I love.
Yeah, so well, the thing about this is that I find quite interesting. I mean, it'd be lovely to. I guess it's a studio thing. You would not want to process that in a live situation, or you could, but it would be a bit sketchy. You know, there would be an issue with that. But
yeah,
the idea, the notion of this kind of digital processing based on sort of Amiga code, I mean, you know, it's almost coming back to another topic that we may get round to, which is this idea that, you know, modern hardware, and you just have a little thing that you dump into the spare memory, and you just get it to do that stuff. And I think that's quite similar to the drum log voices and that sort of thing, which you may get into. Richard, did you get a chance? Did you get a chance to listen to this, Richard? Because the guitar tones, I thought it was just really interesting.
No, I thought the lo-fi vibe was amazing, and I'm all all for doing things the absolute hardest way possible. So this is a perfect example of someone that loves something enough to find ways to include it in their daily life, which I find fascinating. But the sound I thought was really good, and I was immediately thinking, like, that someone, if they could write it, you know, get an emulator together in a box,
yes,
with some dedicated, yes, knobs, you could sell this thing all day today, because the, yes, sounds, I feel like they were, you know, 30 years ahead of their time, because those sounds are so relevant now and so interesting in today's music, that it's almost like a little secret weapon.
I don't know. It's cool, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah. And I suppose
you can run it on a laptop, by the way. Oh, okay. You can emulate it on a laptop, and you can just assign any audio input on the emulation software to pretend to be the sampler cartridge. And then just run it that way. And it run, as I said, that they've had like 30, 40 years to emulate these custom chips, and they've got it really, really good. So you can kind of, you know, just try them out if you want. But yeah, a box would be cool. It should be beige. Yeah, you can run it on a Pi as well. Beige box with knobs, you know, and little lights. It'd be cool.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it works really well on a guitar, because a guitar can be, if it's driven, you know, you're essentially kind of limiting the frequency response anyway. So 8-bit doesn't, yeah, seem like a massive downplay. I know, Robbie, I know you came on at the last minute. I don't know whether you had a chance to check some of the sounds.
Oh, yeah, I've watched.
Oh, okay, good. Well, in that case, then I will ask you the question.
Go on, then. What's the question?
Well, what do you think?
Oh, what do I think? I'm not a guitar-y person. I'm not a pedals person, so I don't really have much skin in that game or knowledge. And I was thinking the exact same thing, was surely somebody somewhere can take this code, put it on a teensy board or a Pi or something, stick it into a pedal, and flog it all day long. Because, you know, those sounds were pretty unique, and it's a lot easier to cart one of those around in your back pocket than it is a whole Amiga rig or a laptop running an emulator. But
that's true.
No, it's lovely stuff. I mean, you know, I come from a world of, you know, sampling, you know, with 8-bit Fairlights and stuff. So I get the whole crunchiness and the quality that sampling into 8-bit and then playing that back offers. It's a nice thing. But then when you start applying that to things like guitars, it's even weirder and nicer to experience, because it's not something you hear that often. So yeah, but always, as always, great video from Paulie. So yeah.
So I'm just curious that the software there that was running, yeah. I didn't catch those algorithms. Were they designed by that coder, or are they the sort of thing that would have been sort of open source at the time? Because there would be obviously some commercial value to using that stuff, and you'd like, yes, to think that the person would get something back from it if you did make it.
Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting. So one piece of software was sold in a box with one of the cartridges. That was the first one I did, called the Real Time Effects Processor, and I showed the box it came in. The second one was freeware. Treg was freeware, by a guy called David O'Reilly. And then the last one, the really wild stuff, Loengard Harmonizer, that I did with the trackball, that was public domain as well, free software, you know, freeware. And I actually managed to find the guy last night, and we've been chatting.
Oh,
so
nice.
It's really nice. And, you know, I said, you know, I mean, your website's full of really unique algorithms and code, and you talk a lot about this stuff, and you're really passionate. Are you on the autism spectrum? I said, and he said, yes, probably, but I'm very high functioning. So we had a little laugh about that, because, you know, the thin line between the genius and madness is definitely there with some of those algorithms.
Which kind of leads me to the point, if you could make something that would run, maybe in Mac's MSP, which would run those algorithms in some kind of emulation, yeah, in a compiled thing, and then you could process your DAW or Ableton Live stuff in there,
yeah,
that might be a thing. I don't know if that's, I mean, because the power that we've got available, I mean, it might be the most efficient thing, way of doing it, but it might be something that was possible, and then you just assign a few macros in live, say, for instance. I'm just thinking of that as sure. It would probably be easier to do that than it would be to create your own VST and all of the kind of business that would...
No, definitely. That's an interesting thought. So you'd need a DAW which could communicate with the emulator, you know, to do all those MIDI macro controls and stuff like that. Thankfully, the Amiga's got a backdoor coding language called AREX, where you can set stuff like that up. So it is possible, Nick, that you could run the emulator, then run your DAW, and then, control one with the other. But, you know, I like the real stuff, you know, the clacky keys and the floppy disks.
I know what you mean, but I'm just thinking, you know, that because I could just imagine people loving what they heard on that and go, yeah, I want to do that, and just being able to sort of buy it or get a Max MS. But that's interesting. I'll look into that. So that might be
someone, an interesting thing. Someone commented on when you reshared it that, oh, great, something else that's going to put the price up of vintage computer hardware. Because ever since lockdown, the price of Commodore 64s, Amigas, older kind of, you know, Windows machines, Atari STs, old Macintoshes, they went up because people escaped to childhood. You know, there was all this terrible stuff going on in the world. So people chose to escape to childhood and they bought their childhood computers in droves. So now the prices are... post-pandemic are just a lot more than they were before.
Although they may end up being the bulwarker of the 20, you know, mid 2020s, where you would
find them endlessly at
car boot sales for people who couldn't be bothered with the hassle.
Who's going to care once, you know, like, obviously I'm an elder millennial who remembers this stuff. Younger millennials than me don't have these references. I know one or two that are into this stuff. So who is actually going to want these computers, like, one day, you know, when my gen isn't here? It's weird. They'll all be in a museum, I imagine, along with a waxwork figure of me holding a guitar. I hope. With really creepy, hologram, you know, possibly. Long stare. Yeah. A hologram, yeah. That talk to visitors, you know.
I don't know if this is all going to fit on the screen. Nick Howe says, is there a copyright time limit on algorithms like there is on, as there is on synths? You know, as there is on creative output. Like, it's 70 years, isn't it, on creative works. I wonder if that's an interesting... I don't know if anybody knows that. It's an interesting question to ask, Nick, but you're probably more qualified to answer it than maybe any of us. I don't know if that's the case. But that would, or maybe Rob's got an insight. No, that's interesting.
Not a clue.
Well, no, the Fairlight... Because, like, for instance, some of the functionality in the original Fairlight code, is that still... Yes. I suppose it must still have intellectual property rights, because that's different to copyrights, isn't it? So that's not the same thing.
It was different back then, though, wasn't it? I mean, I know people that are messing around with Fairlight code, and things will be coming down the line that will use original Fairlight code. But none of the stuff that we see in terms of Fairlight, like the Arturia plugin, doesn't have anything remotely like any Fairlight code in there. It's their interpretation of it. The wonderful free Quasar Beach that Jean-Luc programs. That's a complete ground up rebuild. It's nothing to do with the original code, but the original code is out there. I mean, I've got boxes of floppy disks with the operating system on, if you want to try and get it off there. But it's out there, and people have messed with it over the years. And I know somebody's doing some very good work with it at the moment that we might see in the very near future. But it's
cool.
I don't know. I don't know anything about copyright. It's difficult, isn't it? Especially with the old stuff, because I think copyright is different.
Yeah, I think copyright is different because copyright's for creative works, whereas intellectual property right of technology is protected in perpetuity or for as long as anybody
else. Right.
Well, I guess
Fairlight
that's
don't
why
exist anymore. You see,
no, so. But that's why that's presumably why you have you know, Creative Commons and, you know, various different open source directives and all of that stuff. That's probably an entirely different topic. I'm sorry I brought that up at the very last minute because it's now 5 o'clock. Sorry, I disappeared there for a minute. My network
that's all right.
went But I think what's bizarre is because this is running in the cloud, the show was continuing to run itself while I wasn't able to connect to it. So I don't know what you said or what you did.
That's amazing.
Could have done anything, which is, yeah. So anyway, but that was great.
I wanted
to mention
one thing about it. I got one comment, I think it was on Synthtopia, of a guy who just did not get it. He was like, why are you doing this? Why not use, you know, like modern VST plugins on like Linux or Windows or Mac? Because, you know, you can do most of these effects and stuff like that. And also he said a very pedantic thing, because I said in the title, use the Amiga as a guitar pedal. He said, if you stepped on that thing, it would break. So he really did not get any of the premise of the video. And I don't think
What's he doing on Synthtopia?
I don't know. But he didn't quite understand the appeal of vintage computing, I don't think. And essentially, who is going to watch another video of, because I make videos for people to watch and be interested, who's going to be interested in another video of someone just playing guitar through VSTs that everyone's heard before, you know? So the reason I did it was just to be a little different. I'd found all this software that no one had really heard about and was like, you know, oh, I'll show this off.
And we're all glad you did.
Do you have to put it on a floppy and then load it in, or is there another way that you can get it in there via some sort of serial connection so it makes it a little less treacherous?
I used a floppy disk on purpose for one of the pieces of software in that video, so you could hear in the background the little just for a bit of nostalgia, you know. I call it nerd ASMR. Right. Basically, because so floppy disk and trackball clicks and stuff like that. But the other thing was all of my machines are expanded, and they either run off CF cards or SD cards, right, which are connected to IDE interfaces. You know, the old, is it PATA IDE? They've got PATA IDE, so I have an IDE to Compact Flash, an IDE to one's got SCSI, the 3000, it's amazing. And then I can set up the environment on my laptop with all the software installed, take the card out and put it straight in the Amiga, and it will boot exactly the same. So
that's really cool.
But I use floppy on purpose sometimes because it's just a really nice...
It's like waiting for the tape to rewind. It sort of creates natural breathing spaces within any creative...
Be kind, rewind.
Richard, I mean, you've got vintage technology. I can see you've got cartridge games in there. Do you have a desire for vintage computing in your life? I mean, do you...
Yeah, obviously I have. I love that kind of stuff because it, like Polly said, it reminds me of my childhood. And that's... There's something pleasurable about that. That was the toys that I played with growing up, and, you know, learning how to program on Mac 128 and learning how to play around on a Commodore 64. That's sort of what I remember as a child, other than, you know, being outside riding bikes and whatnot. So yeah, there's an allure to that. And I play with emulators now and then. I don't have any personal excitement about getting that stuff necessarily. I do have an Atari 2600, and that sort of scratched that itch for me. But to be honest, every time I want to play the 2600, I use an emulator.
It's probably quicker, isn't it?
Yeah. But I do have, you know, I have a modded 2600. It'll work with HDMI, which is nice. But again, it's still somehow a pain in the butt. But There's something about those things from your childhood that you draw inspiration from, which is fantastic, because that's your sort of base. You know, when I started making music, I was doing it. I had a Digitech Time Machine rack mount delay, and it had a looping function on it where you could loop up to, I had the 1 second version, so I could loop up to 1 second, and I didn't have any sort of multi-tracking at that point. So I would just sit and loop drum beats and then a little bass line on a keyboard, and then I would loop add my vocals to it after that. You know, so you use this technology that may have sounded terrible at the time and probably still sounds terrible now, but that's sort of irrelevant. It's inspiring to remember those times and then to want to use that gear again as part of your modern workflow. I think it's just a natural thing, because that's the reason why you got into making music, is to get that spark of joy back.
That's a fair point. And that's actually a very good note to end the show on, I think. That's a get the spark of joy back. There we go. That's another contender for the show title. Not bad. Not bad, Richard. You've been very very productive for us. Even though you were late to the party,
I had to condense it.
You showed up with the right beer. okay, well, folks, it's been lovely to have you. I'll come to you, Robbie, first. I guess... you're back into, you know, I'm writing for Gear News, the ProSynth Network. Mm-hmm. What's any big shows coming up for that it's Friday, isn't it, you do your show?
Yep, Friday evening, 7 PM on YouTube and Twitch and various other places, ProSynth Network. We just had our fourth birthday last week and we had a really, you know, really cool show. We had lots of people turn up, like Dina Perlman, Anthony Marinelli, Mick McNeil from Simple Minds. That was a really cool show. This week we're just kind of back down to the ground. What scant news there is, we'll talk about, and it'll just be three old men just wittering on about, you know, why is the sky blue anymore. So yeah, it's good. Some of that, yeah, lots of writing. There are a few things, as you probably well know, there's a lot of big plans, you know, for the next few months. Lots of good things preparing for Superbooth and then Synthesized in Cambridge, where we're going to be joined by a guy called Peter James Stephen, who's in the chat, and we're going to be showing off lots of emulators, and because it's 84 is the kind of the 40th anniversary of the emulator too, so we're kind of celebrating that this year. And there's going to be other things that we're preparing for Synthfest and Bristronica. We're going to be there. ProSynth Network, we're going to have a stand there as well. So that's
amazing.
Nice.
Wow. That'd
be brilliant.
Yeah, it's all kicking off.
Excellent. And Paulie, I guess you could go back to, well, you don't have to go, you, well, I guess maybe you do now. Maybe the kids are back, you go back to being a parent, but you don't have to be a soundtrack mixer this week. You can do other stuff.
I don't know. What I'm going to do is I'm going to release my EP on, I've got a deadline, the 29th of June, because I've got a gig coming up with David Wise, Pete Cannon, and a guy called Hoffman, who are all pretty, you know, big sort of Amiga / video game people. So that's going to be in June at a venue with a capacity of 400 or 500. And I haven't done a gig that big in absolute years. So it's a bit terrifying,
but it'll be great.
But it means, essentially, I'm going to have a load of drunk boomers and older millennials there watching my show. And if I say to them, did you enjoy my show? Would you like to buy a CD? They're going to be like, yeah, we love you, blah, blah, blah. So I'm going to release my EP at that gig and make like 100 or so CDs. Because I've got the cover art back. And yeah, that'll be that. And
that's
hopefully I can sell out. It is a good plan. Drunk people buy CDs.
Yeah, absolutely. I can vouch for that. And Richard Nicol, no doubt back to the world of designing synthesizers and whatnot. Are you going to be in Superbooth? Are we going to see you there?
I am going to be at Superbooth. I can't wait. Yay. That's my favorite week of the year. We're going to be there. Wow. We're going to have lots of fun toys to play with. And I can't wait to walk around and see what everybody has. It's such a... it's sort of such an invigorating week for me, because there's an energy amongst the designers that you sort of feed off of each other. And it sort of boosts your creativity a little bit, because you get a little bit envious of what everybody else is doing. You're like, oh, I could do better next time.
Right.
So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. No, excellent. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thanks to everybody in the chat. Thanks to Wagyu for holding it together on a train. I don't know if he went through any tunnels and we lost connection like I did seem to do here, but I'm not on a train. I don't know what happened there. It's just maybe my service provider just went down briefly. I didn't see an amber light on it, so maybe not. But, folks, thank you very much. That was Sonic Talk 796. We'll see you next time. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye now. Bye.